What's a, you got runs on the board. What does that mean?
Runs on the board?
Yeah.
I'll answer that one first, and we'll come back to second. I look back at, we had an inflow in October of 2006, and if you take a very high-level look, you can say, done a lot of things, but we then suffered another inflow in 2008. The way I look at it is, from 2006 onwards, and my history with the project is only the past 2 years, what you're not seeing in those headlines is the amount of effort that's been put in place to actually put in place a remediation program that started in late 2006 and I believe was executed fantastically through 2007 and early 2008 to seal the inflow on 465. When we went about doing that and took a year and a half or so, it was the first time we ever did that kind of work. It involved a lot of creative, stubborn people who came up with a plan that changed over time as we encountered different situations. And that plan, I believe, was successful in sealing that inflow. We put almost 5,000 cubic meters of concrete underground, drilled many holes, put in a grouting program. Through all of that program, at the end, when we tested the shaft and we pumped it down to look at how much water was flowing into the mine, I believe the number was essentially 95% of the inflow had been sealed off. So we were very comfortable and confident in what we did on 465, and I call that a run on the board. Now, through all that time period, doing that different work for the project, new teams coming in place, people not necessarily familiar with the project, we had no safety incident, no environmental incident, no significant health incident. I call that a run on the board. Through all that time, we're active in the field, we're planning, we're supporting field activities. We're also, with much of the same team, looking at our entire governance structure, our quality management systems, the backbone of our business, the way we want to run the business, and changing it. So we were doing that and executing at the same time. I call that a run on the board. We've been recognized by third parties, by our regulators, as having made significant improvements, and I personally appreciate that comment. We're walking the talk. We're doing what we said we're going to do. We're achieving the kind of performance and safety culture that's been surveyed by third party and achieved significant success there. That's a run on the board. So as we move ahead into 2008, we move back to dewatering, and unfortunately, we encounter a situation on August 12th. That situation didn't occur as a result of a fall of ground or a result of something that we were doing. We were executing in the shaft, and the teams were doing a good job. I call that getting a run on the board. How we dealt with the situation, we knew there was no guarantee that inflows would not occur. We put a plan together that addressed the contingency. If it occurred, how would we manage it? How would we assure the safety of our workforce? How would we ensure the environment was being addressed? We executed that plan, and we were recognized for it. The result on the business was a negative. How we executed it, to me, was another run on the board. And I think that added to the credibility of the team. So then we move forward, and this is a long answer, but I'm quite proud of the team. We move forward in a situation where we don't know where the inflow even originated. And through a lot of interesting creative approaches, including tracking temperature with a probe attached to the ROV, which was an idea of someone's, we found the inflow location. We came up with a creative solution to how we were going to put in place a bulkhead, cement and grout it, and we're probably somewhere in the 75 to 50% of the time to have addressed the last inflow. Hats off to the team. Again, a run on the board. Through all of that, we've continued to progress many of our programs on site. We're still executing surface construction. We're executing it very well. Shaft 2. We sealed off Shaft 2. We secured the bottom. We dewatered it. Perhaps went about it quietly. But that's also been done. Department of Labor stood on the bottom and looked at the work we've done and said, good job. So I think there's a whole series of areas where we've got runs on the board. And that's a long answer, Rudy, but I can share a few more with you as well.
I got two more questions. The first is, roughly, what were the dimensions of the two break-ins?
The initial inflow area, I'm going to have to do a little bit from memory, but as you saw in the photo that was on the screen there, we had a ground fall from the back. So you had the drift dimension there was probably something in the order of 4 to 5 meters, I would say. I don't have the numbers offhand, and probably at least that area deep. And it raveled back up to the inflow or up to the unconformity, somewhere in the order 12 to 15 meters above the drift back. So fairly large. In the case of this inflow, we had something that was started off relatively small, but grew to the size of approximately 15 centimeters and probably spans a couple of meters across the back.
Okay. And how much ground freezing have you done and are you planning to do at Cigar Lake compared to MacArthur River?
Well, Cigar Lake, as Dave mentioned, is a different ore body just through the physical nature of the deposit and the way it's established. So the plan at Cigar Lake and the plan that was being put in place is to use bulk freezing of the ore body as opposed to using freeze curtains. Perhaps Dave can help me here, but in terms of the amount of freeze holes that have been drilled and freezing, not a large portion of the ore body had been frozen, but a fairly significant portion of the initial development area had been frozen up to 2006. The plan is to go back in there, reestablish that freezing system through our remediation, and ultimately freeze the entire ore body.
So you're freezing the ore as opposed to a shell around the ore?
The ore and a shell above and below the ore body.
Hi, can I just follow up on that? So if we're like 2 to 3 meters around MacArthur, are we talking 5 meters around Cigar, given the geometry is a lot different? Or how are you actually going to do that? Because you've got obviously a set of horizontal as opposed to a when we get there.
That's right. The plan today has been to look at a 5-meter shell, and we're assessing now whether that should be increased, stay the same as part of our overall mining strategy and design. So as I said earlier, we have a lot of new information that we've developed over the past couple of years. We also want to integrate all of our previous information. So everything is open right now to us in terms of challenging and confirming or changing those assumptions to come up with the mining strategy and design that gives us what I would call the assurance of success of getting at that 200 million pounds.
And do you think the rock conditions are worse in Cigar than MacArthur? I mean, you've already had a fall at the end of the day, which you never really had in MacArthur per se, which you mentioned one of the reasons for freezing is to give structure to the whole ground around it at the end of the day. You know, is five enough? Why not? Like, I can't believe incrementally to go to six for insurance purposes costs a whole lot more, or does it? I just don't know.
Well, let me speak to a couple of comments you made. Yes, we had a ground fall that occurred and was part of the contribution to the 2006 inflow, but that ground fall had nothing to do with freezing in that situation. And as you're probably well aware from our taproots, there's many different contributing factors as to why that occurred. In the case of Cigar Lake, to your point about 5 meters and cost to go to six and cost to go to seven, all of those type of questions are the things we're asking ourselves right now. And again, what we're positioning ourselves from a chemical perspective is we want, as part of our long-term portfolio, Cigar Lake to be brought on stream. And we want it to be brought on stream so it's a sustainable operation. What we have to do is challenge each of the different assumptions we've been making, the assumptions we are going to make, to assure that we're going to deliver that. And if it means changing from five to six, perhaps we'll do that. But it's one of the things we're questioning. I can agree, we're questioning it.
So, Ken, maybe the final follow-through for that is what's the magic of a 4-year construction license? Because obviously half the challenge here is to go through all this process with the regulators. So if you're saying 4 years, I assume indirectly you're making all those assumptions in that 4-year thing. You don't want to, I mean, why not 5 years or 6 years, just given the history, give yourself as much flexibility as you can. Is there any magic to it? I just don't know. I mean, obviously put a timeline in there for all this stuff. Is that what drives it, or?
No, there's no magic to the number. In the past, we've had 2-year license periods. Certainly for us right now, 2-year license period would mean we're back before the regulator fairly quickly. And I think what we really want to focus on is the project. Rudy asked a question earlier to Dave of what keeps you awake at night, and I like that question. I think what keeps me awake at night is thinking a bit too far ahead. We have to look at what's in front of us, what are the next steps. To Bob's point, the next step is for us to successfully complete remediation of 420, dewater the mine, secure an access, and get ourselves standing down there and then move forward. So I want to make sure our team, and I have these discussions with Tim and Jerry, are focused on those steps. Those steps, successfully planned and executed, are going to deliver the long-term success for us. So from a regulatory point of view, we were looking for a period of time that allowed us to focus on the business at hand, and that's getting back underground, establishing our mining strategy and design, and then ensuring that when we get underground, we can confirm some of our assumptions we're making. And then we're positioned, without having a timeline, to be able to get back to the regulators and say, we've got a plan in place. That's one of our whole points for our Phase 5 we're proposing. We've got a plan in place. Here's what it's based on. But it's driven then by us, and it gives us the flexibility within the operating group or within the projects team to be focused on that.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. I've got three questions. Firstly, you mentioned that some of the development had been undertaken with the assistance of freeze walling. How much of that freeze wall is likely to remain at this point? And if it has totally thawed, I mean, how big a problem could that be? My second question is, with respect to introducing water into the previously dry basement rocks and the impact that might have on the failure envelope of those rocks, can you talk a little bit around that? And then my final question is just with respect to the joint venture partners, and can you talk about their ongoing commitment to the project as it stands at the moment?
I'll, if I could, take them in reverse. The first question is about the commitment of our joint venture partners. Prior to coming here today, I attended our Cigar Lake. It was our regular monthly Cigar Lake Joint Venture Steering Committee meeting that I chair on behalf of the joint venture. And again, we were involved in details of everything from mine planning to obviously costs and everything else you'd be involved in reporting and discussing where we're going with the project. I'm always pleased to go to those meetings because the support we receive from our joint venture partners is solid. They understand. They ask many of the same questions we ask. Obviously, we discuss those things privately, but we receive solid support, and the support for our assurance of success approach is there from all of the partners. So I'm very pleased with that. To go back to your first question about use the term freeze wall, we, again, as opposed to MacArthur, we bulk freeze the deposit, so a portion had been frozen. And what we've been doing, we did it up to the 2008 dewatering and remediation work. We assessed what was the condition based on our own understanding of the Cigar Lake freezing as well as thawing, if you want to call it, or unfreeze technology and modeling. And we also look at MacArthur's experience in terms of freezing and unthawing or unfreezing. And so we looked at that back then, and of course we looked at it again now, and we are looking at it because it's another year and a little bit longer. And we believe when we go underground, the freezing will still be in a position that allows us to get underground. We are looking at some of the logistics within our remediation program, the sequencing of events, so that we reposition some of our rehabilitation, remediation of the brine system and the freezing system so that we get it on. But we believe we'll be positioned to get underground. And your third point was water in the basement rock, and I believe, and perhaps I might miss it some of it, but the fact that we've introduced water into the basement rock that's relatively drier than the sandstone. Our experience so far, our test work, our modeling, says that that should not be an issue for us when we go back underground. We're sensitive to it, and I mentioned earlier in our inflow contingency planning, we've identified a number of scenarios of where potential inflows could occur. We've identified that it could occur in the basement rock. We don't believe that to be highly likely, but it could happen, and we want to be prepared. And as an assurance of success approach, we plan for those things. So we're planned right down to the materials we need, the bulkhead designs, where we'd place them, how we'd handle water. Hopefully it's something we never put in place, but again, assurance of success is planned for it. It occurs, however unlikely, we're ready to react to it.
I have a question on costs. Obviously, freezing ground costs money. That's one part of the question. And the other is mining frozen rock, presumably, is more expensive than mining unfrozen rock because it's harder. And just roughly, how much does this add to a cost of uranium? How much does that add to the production cost? Just very roughly.
Very roughly, Rudy. I think that those are numbers at this point in time that we're really trying to work on and refine as part of our updated mine plan and design. And in doing that, we come back to our joint venture partners. Obviously, Cameco is the manager of the project, but our other partners, and we'll talk about our capital cost estimate as well as our operating cost estimate. So those are numbers that I can't discuss at this point in time. To your point about freezing costing money and mining a frozen ground to be challenging or perhaps more expensive, the nature of the Cigar Lake deposit, as we've seen in the Athabasca Basin, is you have to address the issues of water, the issues of fractured ground, the issues of management of radiation. Freezing is a tool that we've been highly successful in utilizing to allow us to get at those deposits. And dealing with a Cigar Lake or a MacArthur, a plus 20% grade deposit, the economics look a little different when you're dealing with that grade. Yes, it introduces a cost versus a traditional underground mine. Again, what that cost looks like and how it will look like in the future is something we're putting together now.
You must have a good idea what the cost is at MacArthur River per pound produced for the freezing.
I don't personally, but I know Dave does, and you can always follow that up over dinner.